Philip II of Macedonia. Philip attacks Amphipolis, part 2. Now, Philip needed to keep his army fed and free from disease as possible, as long as possible, all the while inspiring the soldiers to keep pressing the siege in spite of the casualties. Evidence from better documented sieges of Alexander's time suggests that far more men were wounded than killed in such fighting. But as the days and weeks passed, the numbers grew steadily. Philip had to convince his soldiers that their suffering was worthwhile because they would win in the end and enjoy glory and rewards of victory. Although the Macedonian losses were inevitably higher than those of the better protected defenders, there were far fewer Amphipolans in the first place. Every loss, whether a man killed, badly wounded, or merely weakened, was proportionately far more serious for them. Philip had a large enough army and to allow soldiers to rest while others prosecuted the siege. Fatigue was far worse for the citizens of Amphipolis, who did not have this luxury, and as the attacks continued, the prospect of defeat loomed even larger. From the start, it was obvious that this attack was far more violent and determined than anything ever attempted by the Athenians. Philip showed no sign of quitting, and gradually his battering rams ate into a section of the city wall. Defenders who surrendered before a final assault were launched had reasonable hope of securing better treatment than if they waited for the city to be stormed and sacked. Sieges placed an immense strain on any polis, pushed at the fractures within a political class. Treachery was so great a risk that the 4th century BCE theorists on siege warfare devoted more space to dealing with this than any threat from the outside. As defeat loomed, the temptation to cut a deal with the attackers in return for personal safety for the leaders, their families, and supporters grew very strong, especially as any deal was likely to be sweetened by reward and the promise of winning political supremacy. Philip later quipped that he could storm any fort to which an ass laden with gold could climb. There was an alternative to surrender, whether by the whole community or treacherous faction, that was to seek aid from the outside. Before the siege began, two aristocrats from Amphipolis traveled to Athens, although it's not clear whether they went with official approval or on their own initiative. Once there, they invited the Athenians to sail and take over the city. Begging for help from their old enemy after almost 70 years of staunchly resisting the restoration of Athenian control. Around the same time, envoys from the Chalcidian League were also in Athens, seeking alliance to strengthen their hand against the bullishly confident Macedonian king. While Athens had an opportunity to regain the great prize of Amphipolis, she had also other concerns. Tension was growing with her allies, and by the end of the year, it would erupt in the war. There were also practical problems. Not so long ago, their expedition to support Argeus had ended in utter failure. If Athens were to confront Philip again, then substantial numbers of men and ships were needed to give any chance of victory. Prevailing seasonal winds were not in their favor in early summer. So depending on when precisely the siege began and how long it lasted, it may have been impractical to sail. Instead of military aid, the Athenians sent two ambassadors, Antiphon and Charidamus, to talk to the king. They found Philip heavily engaged in the siege, but apparently welcoming and willing to negotiate. Precisely what followed is hard to reconstruct, since most of what is known comes from highly distorted versions offered 8 years later by an Athenian orator, Demosthenes. He claimed that Philip won our simple hearts by promising to hand over Amphipolis to us, and by negotiating that secret treaty once so talked about. Other sources claim that it was in the secret treaty the Athenians promised to give Philip the allied city of Pydna in return, and such treachery would explain the need for secrecy. No formal treaty was possible without a public vote in the Athenian assembly, which cannot have happened if the whole affair was believed to be secret. This suggests that there were private talks about a deal and only hints in public sufficient to persuade Athenian citizens that everything was in hand and there was no need for war with the Macedonians. As the summer wore on, Philip's men created a visible breach in the city wall. He attacked, almost certainly leading the assault in person, and broke into Amphipolis. In the ancient world, this did not itself guarantee the end of resistance. Greek cities tended to have very narrow streets between rows of tall houses and other buildings, as well as a citadel within the walls. Determined defenders could continue to fight and sometimes drive the attackers out once more. This time, Philip's men were not going to be denied. They inflicted heavy loss on the Amphipolans before they capitulated. The Greeks expected the fall of the city to be accompanied by massacre and rape and enslavement of the survivors. While the assault may well have been extremely brutal, once the city was secure, Philip was unusually lenient. The men who had led the opposition to him were exiles along with their supporters, but the remainder were not harmed and allowed to stay in their homes and keep the bulk of their property. Although now part of Philip's kingdom, the polis continued to function on a day-to-day basis under its own laws and democratic institutions. There was to be a Macedonian garrison, and a number of Macedonian settlers were introduced. Some land, or at least its produce, was confiscated to provide for these. In addition, Philip controlled all matters of foreign policy, was paid taxes, and took the lion's share of profits from the nearby mines of Mount Paganum. Whatever he had said before and during the siege, Philip clearly never had any intention of handing Amphipolis over to the Athenians. As this truth began to sink in, salt was rubbed into the wound when he followed up his success by besieging and taking Pydna as well. Later in the day, the Athenian assembly voted to declare war on Macedonia. For the moment, there was little more than an empty gesture, but Athens was too occupied elsewhere to do any more. The rebellion of their ally was more immediate priority, and without allies in the area, it would be hard to mount an effective campaign against Macedonia. Now, the sources for this: The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.